DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, a tale of two elections. There's France.
Well, you know, I think in simple terms, it's the future of France that is at stake. Not to sound too dramatic, but it's very much about how people want France to be governed.
And there's the UK.
If you want a growing economy, you have to vote for it. If you want more police on our streets, more teachers in our schools, you have to vote for it.
Join us as we sift our way through this most crucial of weeks in European politics. Oh, and also find out how the actor Michael Sheen became a real-life player in uncovering a major environmental cover-up. That's all here on Inside Europe.
Sommes-nous prêts à donner notre pays, à donner le pays de Victor Hugo?
History is watching us. Are we ready to give our country, the country of Victor Hugo, of Voltaire, of Rabelais, to the Le Pen family? That is the only question that counts. The words there of socialist politician Raphael Glucksmann calling for tactical voting to keep the far right from, as he put it, conquering France by the urn for the first time in the history of the country. Sunday's all-important vote is the second and final round of snap legislative elections called by President Emmanuel Macron in response to his party's humiliating defeat in last month's European Parliament elections. Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally, or Rassemblement National Party, came top of the first round, so now the question is, will tactical voting be enough to keep the party from power? To get a sense of the stakes, I turned once again to Nabila Ramdani, author of Fixing France, How to Repair a Broken Republic.
Well, you know, I think in simple terms, it's the future of France that is at stake. Not to sound too dramatic, but it's very much about how people want France to be governed. Do they want a centrist, moderate government? Do they want a left-wing one? Or indeed a far-right extremist government? But I think more generally, this is a sign that the Fifth Republic system of government is not fit for purpose. And we are facing, at the very least, months and indeed years of paralysis and non-government, or at the very worst, very serious social problems in a country that is only 2 years to violent revolution. Crisis can be a misused word, but this is clearly a very grave time in the history of modern France. And it's quite common to see fleets of armored police vans on street corners in Paris. But I certainly think that officers have been looking particularly tense in recent days.
The Rassemblement National, Nabila, already enjoys regional power in various places. What does that experience tell us about what we can expect to happen, how we can expect lives to be impacted and changed if, in one of the possible scenarios coming out of this weekend, they do gain an absolute majority and control of institutions and budgets?
Well, this is a key question, really. Governments have a huge impact on people's lives. The real job of any politician is handling power. And the National Rally has not given any sign at all that they are capable of doing this. They appear to be negative about everything and have very little idea about how the real world works in terms of economics, social policy, and the nuts and bolts of serious government. They seem to be changing the policy commitments with the wind. I mean, the National Rally is very much a one-issue party, and they will introduce anti-immigrant policies because this is its main agenda. Beyond a well-recorded history of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and other forms of racism, the National Rally has in recent days been talking about ending, for example, the age-old right of people born in France to foreign parents to be granted French nationality. They've also been talking about banning dual nationals from holding jobs in the public sector, and indeed of banning the headscarf in public spaces, including on the streets. But overall, their social policy can be summed up by the phrase national preference, which is a euphemism for what are effectively discriminatory, not to say racist proposals. So one would imagine that national rally policies will become even more discriminatory if they do actually win an absolute majority in the National Assembly in a few days' time. What is terrifying is that their would-be Prime Minister, Jordan Bardella, has displayed horrific prejudice against ethnic and minority groups in his short public life. He's only 28. And I think that making him Prime Minister will embolden him enormously. He will become a very dangerous figure as far as ethnic and religious minority groups are concerned, while also bankrupting the country, because just like the economic policies, most, if not all, of their social policies are in fact illegal under the French Constitution. And the Council of State has ruled that frequently.
Right. Okay. So this sort of key concept that the policies being pursued by the Rassemblement National put it at odds with the fundamental values of the République. Now, after the first round, the left-green alliance Front Populaire promptly rebranded itself Front Républicain, announcing that it would stand down any candidate in constituencies where they had come third, and that's in order to enable tactical voting against the Rassemblement National. What about other parties? Has President Macron's grouping, for example, done the same?
Yes, absolutely. Macron has shown that he's willing to do deals with anybody, including working with the Popular Front and not working with allies of the far-right National Rally, in an effort to keep the National Rally out of power. And he's doing it in a strategic way. For example, the leftist Popular Front is allowing his former Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, a free run against the National Rally in her Normandy constituency, while Macron is allowing the Front Populaire, or the Popular Front, François Ruffin, a clear run against the National Rally in his own hometown of Amiens. Gabriel Attal, the outgoing prime minister, has even said that moderates should work with the extreme left, LFI or France Unbowed, to keep the far right out of power.
And that really is, sorry, Nabila, that really is quite a crucial development, isn't it? Because up until the results of the first round, the rhetoric from the presidential camp had been very much along the ni l'un ni l'autre, neither one nor the other, not the extreme right, not the extreme left.
Yes, absolutely. I think the president's majority and indeed coalition are trying to be very pragmatic about it, and therefore making sure that even people they view as not in tune with in terms of policies can get along. But as always, there are mavericks in every party who do not want to do what their leaders tell them to do. And this is the case in all political situations, especially when you're dealing with a constantly changing party like Emmanuel Macron's. So it is his party is by no means known for being a loyal one. And that's why you see some of his candidates not abiding by his line.
When I first spoke to you, Nabila, it was last year, and you'd just published your book, Fixing France, How to Repair a Broken Republic. And I remember that back then, the main thesis, which was, you know, basically that French democracy is broken and needs fixing, it seemed controversial and provocative. But now, with the far right on the cusp of legislative power, I think there'd be very few people that would be disputing that claim. So I suppose what I wanted to ask you was, do you believe that the Republic can still be fixed?
Yes, very much so. I'm an optimist, and like all Republican citizens, believe in the power of revolution. And a revolution doesn't need to be a violent one, I hasten to add. I absolutely abhor violence of any kind. But I do think that massive and radical change is urgently needed in the makeup of modern France. And beyond the chaos that is undoubtedly coming out of this current parliamentary election, we are facing the very real prospect of Marine Le Pen becoming president of France in 2027 on a single presidential vote. And this will give her such extraordinary power that she won't even need to bother with parliament and could be ruling by decree. And this is concerning enough when a relative moderate like Emmanuel Macron is the power player in charge. But pretty terrifying when and if a nativist nationalist with a massive antipathy towards immigrant and indeed anyone perceived as an immigrant takes over. So I think this potential constitutional crisis is a case in point as to why the French Republic needs urgent fixing. And this is why the overarching argument in my book, Fixing France, is that the French system itself is a colossal failure and needs urgent fixing, up to and including the creation of a new constitution that would be called the Sixth Republic. We need to move on from this rigid presidential system to a more balanced and genuinely a democratic parliamentary form of governance.
Nabila Ramdani is author of Fixing France, How to Repair a Broken Republic. For the latest election news, download DW's breaking news app or follow the DW Europe handle on social media. To the UK now, where major political shifts are also afoot. As we headed to studio, national elections were still underway, with voters set to decide whether to end 14 years of right-wing Conservative Party rule. Polls suggest the centre-left Labour Party is on course to win their biggest majority in nearly 100 years, but whoever wins, and whatever the mandate, the incoming Prime Minister will have their plate full. The UK is grappling with a healthcare system in crisis, its role in the war in Ukraine, a faltering economy, and much more besides. And how the next leader responds will define the country for years to come. Dan Ashby has this overview of the likely in-tray.
I understand why you're frustrated with our party. With me, I get it. But this is not a by-election. It's a choice with profound consequences for you and our country.
The Conservative leader, Rishi Sunak, in one last bid to Britain. During a TV debate between the two main parties' leaders, he once again accused his opposite number of planning to raise taxes and of not being straight with the electorate.
Can you afford to pay at least £2,000 more in tax? And why won't Keir Starmer be straight with you about what he wants to do?
But Labour's Mr. Starmer hit straight back, urging the public to usher in change.
If you want your NHS back, you have to vote for it. If you want a growing economy, you have to vote for it. If you want more police on our streets, more teachers in our schools, you have to vote for it.
But for the new Prime Minister, that change he is calling for won't be easy. Britain's public services are in crisis. There are record waiting times in hospitals, court cases can't be heard, and local councils are going bankrupt.
As a whole, public services in the UK are in what you can only really describe as a dire state.
Dr. Parth Patel is a senior fellow from the Institute of Public Policy Research.
Yeah, I mean, they're incredibly serious. They're absolutely unprecedented in that we've never seen waiting times to this extent in sort of the history of the British welfare state.
But he says the challenge is the government has little money and needs big ideas.
So the amount of money that can be raised to further finance public services comes with constraints. And even with more money, it's clear to everyone that public services in this country need reforming. They need modernising into the 21st century. And that is a difficult task. That requires...
A difficult task, made more tricky, some say, by the arrival of thousands of migrants each year, who are often accused of putting pressure on Britain and its services. Dr. Matt Beach is the director of the University of Hull's Centre for British Politics, and he says illegal migration poses a challenge to this government, as it did the last.
Britain's always been a very welcoming country and a country that's needed international migration, but the sheer numbers of illegal criminal gangs operating and the Conservative government's inability to turn the boats back, turn them back to the continent, turn them back to France, and get a grip with this has been one of the big central questions, which has undermined people's sense of competence in the Conservative Party.
With so much expectation of a Labour landslide, many thought this moment would be similar to 1997, when a young Tony Blair came to power. But the world has changed.
Brexit was one of the first symptoms of the crisis in globalisation that we're now seeing around the world.
The new government faces a far more unstable world, with war in Europe, the rise of Trump and a bullish China, all challenges that affect everything from migration to the economy. A key task will be working out a future with the EU and deciding what it means to be a small but rich set of isles, separate from the big powers. Dr. Patel again.
The UK is one of these very important middle powers now in a world of middle powers, and the role it decides to take will be critical for what happens in the United Kingdom, for its domestic populations and their well-being, as well as on the global stage for what happens in global relations.
It sounds daunting, at times even overwhelming, but the British political system allows for strong governments, which can change the fabric of the country. To this new leader, it may feel like winning the election was hard, but that was the easy bit. Dan Ashby, DW, in the UK.
We're actually going to be hearing more from Dan Ashby in just a minute, along with his partner, personal and professional, Lucy Taylor. Just why will be revealed shortly, but here is a clue. The answer is buried.
Poison in the water, still the fact remains. You deny it ever happened, deny it ever will. Deny it ever happened, but it keeps on happening still. There's poison in the water, poison in the rain. Poison in the water, but still the fact remains. You deny it ever happened, deny it ever will. Deny it ever happened, but it keeps on happening still.
Regular listeners to the programme will know both Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor from their reports for us in their capacity as Inside Europe UK correspondents. What you may not know, however, is that together they make up the two halves of the small production company Smoke Trail, which specialises in investigative environmental reporting. The BBC have just released the second series of their award-winning podcast, Buried, and this time it delves deep into the murky world of a mass-scale toxic chemical cover-up. I binge-listened the whole lot in one sitting and then promptly hauled Dan and Lucy into a digital studio to talk it all over with me.
So we got a box of evidence. I mean, it's an investigative journalist's dream, I guess, but we had dossiers piled up in our lounge and confidential documents, and it's the evidence of a witness who's passed away. And in 1967, he walked into a field and he found these deformed calves, horribly deformed cows, and it really moved him. And he spent a lifetime trying to find out what happened and believed there was this huge chemical secret going on, that one of the world's most famous chemicals was actually contaminating the British food chain. And what intrigued us about this story is that he said he was beaten up, that he was put in witness protection, and all these other things happened to him. So straight away, we thought this is a big and important, urgent story, and we had to find out what was going on.
So there was a tape. Before he died, he'd recorded his story.
Yeah, well, someone recorded it for him, and that's a bit of a twist, really, because the person who recorded that life story of this man who no one else had really listened to was himself a Hollywood actor, Michael Sheen. He actually came across the story when he was living in LA, browsing Wikipedia, and he found one line about this man and went down a rabbit hole and got so intrigued that he decided to try and find out more about the story. And he ended up coming to the UK, to Douglas's home, to record him for a whole weekend. Like, they did a 7-hour interview together, which is just extraordinary. I don't think most actors operate like that. And I can't imagine what this man thought when Michael Sheen came to interview him. He must have been delighted. But then after that, Michael didn't really know what to do with it. And I think it ended up sort of sitting in a drawer for several years, because he realized that this needed a journalist. It needed somebody to investigate the story. And he didn't really know who to turn to. And then by coincidence, 6 years later, we found a mention that Michael had made in a lecture about this man, saying that he'd done this interview. So we contacted Michael Sheen, thinking, well, this is not going to go anywhere because he's way too famous to talk to us. And actually, he was really interested, and we ended up going to his house. He came round to all these kind of potentially contaminated sites with us. He met scientists and pulled over lab results with us. And we kind of formed podcasting's strangest team, Hollywood actor, two journalists, and a few other campaigners along the way, to make this podcast and investigate. What we were really looking at was not just the story that happened in the 1960s, but actually what's happening today. And are these chemicals still contaminating the land today in a way that we need to be concerned about?
Yeah, this is the moment where it's a
dark dive if you've not come across this before, because what the witness was onto was something that we now call forever chemicals. And these are chemicals that they use in industry. They do have some benefit to us commercially. They're often fire resistant or stain resistant, but they endure in the environment for decades or hundreds of years. They get inside and attach themselves to proteins and can do all sorts of horrible things to not just animals, but to humans too. So we looked at this one chemical, group of chemicals, PCBs, that the witness was worried about. We tested soil in the UK, and we were completely shocked to find 12,000 times over the UK background level in one of our samples. Our scientist who we were working with almost fell off his chair, said it was the highest he's ever found. And so we went on to then test our food. We even found one fish that had such high levels of PCBs that it would be illegal to sell. And then finally, the kind of darkest moment, I guess, for us was we tested our own blood. It's hardly ever been done. It's almost never been done on air in that way. And we were told that we have 80 of these chemicals each in our blood. It doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to get cancers or all the things associated with these chemicals, but it was just a marker that this is a really big problem that's only going to get worse.
And presumably, if I were to test my blood, I'd get similar results, because that's the whole point. These things are everywhere. You can't avoid them.
Yeah, we found that a kind of emotional thing to think about, really. The fact that, yeah, all of us now have these man-made chemicals inside us because of the way that they've spread through the environment into the food chain. And not just that, but we'll pass them on to future generations as well. They pass through the placenta, they pass on through breast milk. So this group of chemicals that were banned before I was born, I now have inside me, and the future generations of our children will have inside them as well.
I feel like now that I've got you, I get to sort of go all fangirl and share my favourite moment from the podcast, can I?
Yes, sure, yeah.
So it's a moment where it's sort of almost Dantean, because you're in this boggy field and there's this figure that sort of appears seemingly out of nowhere. And it's totally weird, because there are things about him that remind listeners and you of your original witness, but he's not, he's somebody else. And is he threatening, or is he taking on a guide function? We're not sure, but there you are with him in a boggy field, stumbling towards what are possibly some sort of spilled chemicals, in the company of Michael Sheen in disguise with a beanie hat. Nobody recognises Michael Sheen. It's just totally surreal.
Yes, and a bit of a, and we haven't said this before in a public setting, so this is new for everyone. But the other thing that happened then is that we were also being filmed by a strange other character, a young man in a hoodie who sort of stayed in around the bushes and filmed us in a slightly menacing way. Not a Michael Sheen fan, I can assure you. And so there was also an element that we were concerned about, kind of nefarious forces around us in this scene. And it was totally surreal to walk into a village and then a strange man pop up and say, "I will take you to this toxic, most contaminated site in the UK and show you that it's still leaking." But all the while be sort of, as you say, going on about house prices, will these house prices be affected in the UK and all that sort of thing. And you're thinking, is this real? Is this? And it just was a perfect emblem of where we are with these chemicals, which I think is that we're sort of aware that it's going on and we're trying to look away.
Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor, they're partners in crime investigation. And if you hadn't already guessed, partners in real life too. Buried is out on BBC Sounds and all the other usual platforms. This is Inside Europe. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Dum 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 d
listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Germany. We've got a special sports focus coming up for you next as we ask whether the Seine is really clean enough for Olympic athletes to swim in, investigate Spain's Grand Prix microboom, and the US attempt to crack the UK sports market. And after the sports comes the schism. Literally, we'll be hearing all about an archbishop on trial for defying the Pope.
What I find interesting, though, is that Archbishop Viganò was at the heart of the Roman Curia during John Paul II, and that was just a few decades ago.
Stay tuned.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
Alors je sais, il y a encore plein de gens sceptiques. Vous savez, les gens qui font gna 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 toute la journée. Alors les gna 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 et les gna gna gna, je leur dis que en fait oui, on va nager dans la Seine.
Ah, how the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, must be longing for those balmy days. Only a few weeks ago, when the toughest political questions for her to dodge were all related to her much-mocked promise to bathe in her swimsuit, she always seemed to stress that bit for some reason, in the Seine. Basically, she'd promised to do it to show her confidence in the big river cleanup effort that's been a key part of Paris's preparations for this summer's Olympic Games, but then kept finding reasons why the time wasn't yet quite right, much to the hilarity of the French talk show circuit.
Yann Marguet, les législatives repoussent encore la baignade d'Anne Hidalgo dans la Seine.
Oh non ! Encore une raison de ne pas le faire ! C'est dommage !
Now, of course, France's shock legislative elections and the very real possibility of the far right achieving an absolute majority in Parliament mean that Anne Hidalgo's bathing bravado is nothing more than a forgotten sideshow. And yet, in 3 weeks' time, the Olympic Games will begin in Paris, and one of the events will be the triathlon, and the triathletes will be swimming in the Seine. So, is it clean enough? John Lawrenson has been finding out.
The River Seine, winding through the ancient heart of Paris, under all of those pretty bridges, is one of the most beautiful sights in one of the most beautiful cities in the world. But public confidence about it being clean enough to swim in for the Summer Olympics is low.
Would you swim in this water?
No.
Why not?
No way. Because just look at the color of it. I would not swim in it. Yeah, it
Nature.
Smells really bad, so I would definitely not go into it.
I actually wouldn't, because I've seen too many rats around Seine, and I don't really feel comfortable doing that.
5 years ago, no. Maybe today, but on only certain days, because there's a lot of things that are flushing things into here. But yeah, I would also swim and then take antibiotics.
Skepticism is understandable. Readings show that E. coli, the bacteria in fecal matter, is still at higher than acceptable levels about 30% of the time, which is not surprising given that, at least until very recently, untreated sewage has been flowing into the Seine from thousands of houses upriver, leaking from sewage pipes and pumped quietly into the water from houseboats. Not to mention the fact that when it rains hard, sewage has, again up to now, simply overflowed from the drains into the river. But at Paris Town Hall, the deputy mayor in charge of the Seine, Pierre Rabadon, says the problems will be fixed in time, more or less.
8 ans, c'est le temps de déploiement des investissements du plan Beignet.
Over a period of 8 years, €1.4 billion have been spent on improving, first of all, the quality of the water released from our sewage treatment facilities. We've also built a reservoir to collect the sewage that backs up during heavy rains to prevent or at least delay it spilling into the Seine. Half of the 20,000 houses upstream, whose sewage was going into the river, will be connected to the mains drainage by July. Practically all the houseboats, too. I'm confident that it will make the Seine clean enough for the Olympics and to allow swimming in the Seine for the general public in 3 places in Paris from next year.
I go back down to the side of the river where children on bateau-mouche tourist boats scream every time they go under a bridge. This one is actually Alexandre III Bridge, where Monsieur Rabadon is so confident the Olympic and Paralympic free swimming will be taking place. I've come here to meet someone who knows more about swimming in the Seine than just about anyone. Arthur Germain is his name. When he was 16, he became the youngest French person to swim the English Channel. And more recently, he spent 50 days swimming the whole length of the Seine from its source in Burgundy to the sea. Even more amazingly, he is Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo's son. In any case, swimming in the Seine is, he says, an unforgettable experience.
When I came, I remember in the first bridge, Le Pont National of Paris, I cried because it was like something I wanted to do in my life, and I was here, and the emotion took me down, you know. And yeah, when I went, I remember in the near the Musée d'Orsay. It was like beautiful, and yeah, it's like a different point of view, you know.
And you didn't fall ill?
No, I wasn't ill the entire journey.
A bit like the Japanese Prime Minister who's been eating sashimi from Fukushima, both Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo and President Macron have promised to strip down to their swimmers and swim in the Seine this summer. If, even more daringly, they put their heads underwater, they might see one or two of the 32 species of fish that can now be found in the Seine, where 50 years ago there were only three. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
The ever-dry John Lawrenson there, this time quite literally, and that is despite us offering to cover the cost of a plastic mic covering if he took the plunge. Oh well, I suppose that the games haven't quite opened yet, so there is still time, John. For Spanish motor racing fans, however, the year's highlight is already past. Late last month, the Spanish Grand Prix concluded not far from Barcelona, with race organisers saying that it produced the highest ever turnout amongst fans and tourists. Ashish Sharma went along to soak up the buzz of the economic microboom.
Well, I'm in the very heart of Barcelona in Plaza Catalunya, and the whole area has been shut down because the Formula One roadshow has just rolled into town. It's the first one they've held just ahead of the Spanish Grand Prix. The top drivers have been putting on an exhibition, and there are thousands of people that have lined up on either side. The lucky ones hanging off balconies, many more climbing trees, and even more sitting on top of bus stops. The roadshow of bringing the top cars and some of its drivers into the centre of Barcelona was organised for the first time ever. And it proved to be an instant hit, as more than 40,000 people lined up to wave on their heroes. Many are devoted to the sport and chase F1 races up and down the continent.
Team Ferrari. I don't care.
People like Helma, who travelled from the Netherlands with her husband to their holiday home in Alicante before embarking on a mini Grand Prix tour around Europe.
Then we go from here to the Austria Grand Prix and then the free from Hungary.
Wow.
And then back to the Hollands again. So, yeah.
And you've been doing this, what, how many years now?
I think it's about 8 years here, and the combination of three of them is, I think, about 5 years now.
That must be tiring, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad when I'm back home again, because yeah, my husband's sitting in a wheelchair, and it's not always easy doing everything alone for all the time, but it's okay, it's okay.
Over the 3 days, that included Friday's warm-up, Saturday's qualifying, and the actual race itself on Sunday, a record number of just under 300,000 people attended. It means an event like this and the level of tourism that it generates is big business for the local community.
This is what I like.
Sylvia Brunette runs the Hotel Augusta, which overlooks the racetrack. She is already fully booked for the event in 2025.
Formula One all the week is amazing for all the hotels and also for the area. Now it's finished and we are still are talking about this week, this amazing week, because it's full of people everywhere, traffic everywhere, restaurants are full. helicopters flying around the circuit, and also from here, from to Barcelona, beaches are also full. The Formula One guest is easy guest. They know very well the service, the hotel we can give to them. But for me, is one of the best week of the year. We have a contract with all the teams that we keep the rooms for next year and also for the other season.
This boost in tourism and the international media coverage that any F1 race brings to a host city has transformed the small town of Montmeló, where the racetrack is located. Pierre Rodriguez is the mayor of Montmeló.
Montmeló is a little village. It's 8,800 inhabitants. It wants to remain as a beautiful little village. And Formula One and the circuit actually has given name to Montmeló worldwide. Everybody knows where Montmeló is, and everybody knows that there's a circuit here that once a year has a competition that is seen all around the world. And for Montmeló, it's kind of being proud of having it, and also an economic impact.
How has Montmeló benefited directly then?
Some industries related to mobility or to competition have been installed all around the circuit. And we have some 3, 4, 6 companies, high-value companies, which hire engineers and are doing development, are next to the circuit because they want to be near the circuit for testing purposes. And I think it has to be with the new mobility, with the electric mobility. The car industries had to be very, very, very big. And for the new mobility, it don't necessarily have to be like this. They are in Montmeló and they give high value through the occupation in Montmeló. Having an industry with 150 engineers, it's not something common. It's not something that happens every day in Montmeló.
Yet despite its obvious popularity and the number of tourists that the Formula One races bring, Barcelona's future is under threat. And that's because the Spanish capital, envious of the success of the race, has signed a deal with the owners of Formula One to host Grand Prix in Madrid from 2026 onwards. Whether that means that the Spanish Grand Prix will move home and head to Madrid in the future, or that Spain gets to host 2 Formula One races, remains to be seen. But wherever it goes, the Grand Prix will bring with it its own jamboree of tourists and fans. Ashish Sharma, DW, Barcelona.
Yup, sports these days is a big bucks business, so holding that thought, here is a question for you. If you have a product which has already cornered the domestic market, what do? You find new markets to conquer, right? You start selling your product abroad, start finding new customers who are going to champion your product and spread your message in their own country. Well, that is pretty much the strategy that various US sports have been pursuing, with London as a key centre of gravity. Later this month, the US men's and women's national basketball teams will play 2 games each, and the National Football League will return to the British capital in October with 3 games. Last month, the US Professional Baseball League, the MLB, took over London with back-to-back games. A potential growth market? Our reporter Ben Batka seems to think so.
In early June, a few thousand baseball fans were celebrating a warm-up party at London's Trafalgar Square. Inside a large cage, slightly larger than an MMA cage, baseball legends were competing in batting or the hitting of balls. 25-year-old Jabesh Bhaskaran is British and started playing baseball 3 years ago. He was wearing a red baseball cap with a white P on the front that stands for his favorite team, the Philadelphia Phillies, currently the most successful team in Major League Baseball.
The more TV shows from America that I watch, the more baseball I see, and I kind of just like watching the game. It's a good combination of like teamwork and also individual skill. Obviously, when you're fielding, it's a team, it's a collective, it's a unit. But then when you're up to at bat, it's you and it's up to you to perform. I knew about the London series last year. I think the teams that were involved weren't of interest to me. And then I found out that this year's London series was going to be Philly, so I had to get involved.
Bhaskaran bought tickets for both games for the equivalent of around €240, a hefty price compared to the average price of around €70 for a ticket to a soccer game of England's Premier League. at least his travel costs were comparatively low. According to the MLB, well over a third of spectators came from abroad, most of them by far from the USA.
I came all the way from freaking Costa Rica. This is my Disneyland. I love baseball games. They're just such a happy place. Grew up in Philly, so go Phils!
American fans of the New York Mets, the Phillies' opponent in London, also flocked to the British capital by the thousands. Mitzi, a 34-year-old New Yorker, says she spent around 2,000 euros for 3 nights, including tickets and hotel.
So I've never been to London, never been to Europe. Haven't really had any conversations with any British fans. I don't think they exist. That's the point of like this, right? To have people come and like, okay, see your sport. I don't think they're into baseball.
That's not quite true. If you believe the MLB's figures, the number of its British fans actually doubled to around 2.5 million between 2019 and 2022. In 2019, the Boston Red Sox and record champions New York Yankees played the first of three series in London. According to Ben Latkin, managing director of MLB Europe, the league has been trying to gain a foothold in the European sports market since 2017. Latkin says the marketing strategy aims to keep the core brand authentic while adapting to the target market.
So we're bringing that great Americana and everything that Major League Baseball is in the US across here. On the screens, we adapted the boards so that we had explainers, and in terms of the broadcast, that's where we really concentrate on having someone who is able to just take people through the game. But we do know that in our content, we need to make sure that we are giving people that ability to get into the game and understand the game. And we're trying to create some British kind of traditions as well. We have the Great British Mascot Race as one of the innings breaks.
Latkin says the expansion in the UK is based on three pillars. Live events such as the three London series to date, or so-called watch parties. And there's TV broadcasts and content on social media. And finally, sports promotion with the aim of increasing the number of players. One example of sports promotion is the six-week First Pitch program. The MLB says around 14,000 schoolchildren aged 8 to 12 took part in it last year. In 2022, the 30 teams in Major League Baseball generated around $10 billion in revenue, second place worldwide behind the National Football League, the NFL, which generated a whopping 80% more revenue. This is despite the fact that an MLB season has 9 times as many games. And the NFL is several steps ahead of the MLB in Europe. Since 2007, the NFL has played a total of 36 games in London compared to the MLB's 6. According to Sebastian Urich from the Cologne Sports University, the MLB has another competitive disadvantage.
Compared to the NBA and especially the NFL, I clearly see the MLB in third place in Europe, mainly because baseball doesn't have the same representation and the same level of interest in almost all countries. Basketball and now also American football have a much higher level of consumption capital here. This means that there are quite a few people who know these sports, including the rules, players, and so on. It makes a huge difference. The better I know a sport, the more I enjoy it, appreciate it. In order to market itself successfully in Europe, the MLB must first generate consumers with expertise.
Despite the domestic competition, MLB Europe managing director Latkin believes that his league can continue to grow in Europe.
From our research, we've seen there are really strong overlaps between fans of the NFL and the NBA and fans of MLB. So actually, if someone is an NFL fan or an NBA fan, we think actually they're ripe for being a Major League Baseball fan as well. We also look at the cricket audience.
In the UK, around 5,000 men and women play baseball and 15,000 play softball. Both softball and baseball have been Olympic sports since the 22/21 Tokyo Games. According to John Boyd, CEO of the British Development Organization for Baseball and Softball, one of the biggest challenges is the costly maintenance of the baseball fields, also known as diamonds because of their shape.
Our sport is an emerging sport here. It is competing with other major sports that get a lot of local authority investment into maintenance and upkeep, like rugby. So a lot of the times, the fields that we play in are maintained by the clubs, the volunteers within the clubs. However, it is an ongoing challenge, and particularly as a small ball sport, having a flat playing surface that you can field off is absolutely critical.
Fans of both the Mets and the Phillies got their money's worth at the two games at London Stadium. From 3 home runs over a 2-foot-long hot dog on offer to mascot races and the spectacular end of the second game with a splintered baseball bat. Yet, the third edition of the London series was not a total success. Around 1 in 10 seats remained unoccupied. Jabesh Bhaskaran, the baseball player from Trafalgar Square, was nevertheless quite happy with the result.
I'm still really excited. I think both games were really, really fun. They're all players I've watched on TV, and I'm seeing them face, like, looking at their, like, how they act when the camera's not on them, how they're fielding, where they're standing, how they communicate to each other, seeing it live in the flesh. It's great.
European MLB fans will have to wait until 2026 for the next baseball spectacle. Games planned for 2025 in Paris were cancelled last November, apparently because the league was unable to find an organizer and the games would not have been financially viable. The NBA, on the other hand, will hold 2 games in the Olympic City in January, and the NFL will return to Europe in the fall with 3 games in London and 1 in Munich. Ben Bartke, DW, London.
Thanks very much for coming. Have a lovely weekend. Goodbye. Cheers. Thank you.
Time now to really put the sporting cats amongst the pigeons. Show us your colours. What, according to your heart, is the correct term for the 11-a-side game of 2 halves, 2 goals, and 1 round ball? Is it soccer or football? What a way to find out where our listeners are based. Last week, we sent you on a quest to identify countries through which the river Danube runs, and you were basically all right because the only country where the river didn't run through was Estonia. Our weekly quiz is available to listeners via our Spotify app, but we are, of course, available on all the other usual platforms, and that includes YouTube via DW's podcast channel. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, here's a word I've always wanted to say on Inside Europe. Schism. No, not a figurative schism. We're talking here about the crime of schism as defined by the Catholic Church. So, according to Catholic canon law, a schismatic is a baptized person who, though continuing to identify as a Christian, refuses submission to the Pope or fellowship with members of the Church. Schism is a big deal. And you can be tried for it, which is exactly what is happening to an Italian archbishop who was once an envoy to Washington, but who now says he doesn't recognise the authority of the Vatican court and so is refusing to participate in his own trial. From Rome, Megan Williams has more.
The most famous accusation of schism was launched 5 centuries ago against Martin Luther. The German monk had nailed to the door of his local church his 95 theses, accusing the Vatican of corruption by pressuring the poor to buy indulgences, certificates that claimed to reduce punishment and purgatory for sins. That led to an event the Catholic Church has never quite recovered from, the Protestant Reformation. And let's not even talk about the one that led to the creation of the Orthodox Church 5 centuries earlier. This latest accusation of schism was made public via a tweet in mid-June and is, to put it mildly, a much smaller and, well, more fringe affair. The Italian accused of the Vatican crime, Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, has been in hiding for a number of years now. He's the one who tweeted, posting the formal summons from the Vatican Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith, the Doctrine Watchdog Office. It ordered him to appear for an extrajudicial trial, citing as evidence, quote, public statements that show a denial of the necessary elements to maintain communion with the Catholic Church.
It is pretty unusual,
says Vatican observer Jacopo Scaramuzzi of the schism charges, citing just a couple of schism cases in the past century.
But there are likely several accusations that we do not know about.
What we do know is how much disdain the arch-conservative Archbishop Vigano has for Pope Francis.
Quell'inchiesta che fu ordinata da Papa Benedetto non ha avuto più nessun seguito.
In 2018, accusing Francis of having ignored sexual abuse and calling on him to resign.
Mentre uccidevano deliberatamente i contagiati per farci accettare mascherine.
In 2021, accusing governments of letting people die of COVID on purpose to scare citizens into wearing masks and lockdowns, which Francis supported.
Una battaglia epocale.
And last year, praising Russian President Putin and former U.S. President Trump for safeguarding Christian civilization, while blaming the so-called deep state and deep church for putting Francis in place.
The modernists want to be treated with oil, soap, and caresses. Instead, we need to fight them with our fists.
That's all been public for a while and likely didn't prompt the schism charge against Vigano. Vatican observer Francis X. Rocca says the timing could be a reflection of a Pope Francis who seems to have become less patient with critics.
It's puzzling. I mean, the Pope has, in recent months, punished two other conservative critics, although neither of those critics is on a level with Vigano. Vigano has been unbridled and extravagant and sensational in his attacks on the Pope increasingly over the last 6 years.
Another explanation? Vigano's plan to set up a monastery near Rome for anti-Francis priests that might gain legitimacy as a movement the Pope wants nipped in the bud. On the day of the deadline to respond to the summons in late June, Vigano posted online a lengthy statement accusing Pope Francis of heresy and schism, and said he had, quote, no reason to consider myself separate from communion with the Holy Church. 500 years ago, when Martin Luther was excommunicated for schism, he had thousands of fellow clergy supporters. Vigano, on the other hand, has a handful.
What I find interesting, though, is that Archbishop Vigano was at the heart of the Roman Curia during John Paul II, and that was just a few decades ago.
Meaning, there may still be a lot of bishops and cardinals who agree with Vigano, but are keeping quiet. Scaramuzzi says Pope Francis, even with his recent gay slurs and position against female priests, has managed to slowly open up the Catholic Church through reform.
Which, by the way, are very careful reforms, but still are creating a lot of resistance. It means that the Catholic Church has a huge difficulty to undergo changes.
And not this rare accusation of schism is the Pope pushing back. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
By the authority hereby invested in me, I hereby pronounce this episode of Inside Europe closed. This program was produced by Helen Sini with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineer Siad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.
Should I buy this new book or make the switch to an e-reader?
Paper or plastic?
Oh, I forgot my own bags. Plastic. No, wait, paper. Hang on, which one's better? Is it time to trade in my car for an EV? How bad are disposable contact lenses for the environment? Should I get a real Christmas tree or a fake one? Is it better to eat local or organic? I don't know!
Don't stress, Neil. The podcast Living Planet is here to help. We know you want to do what's right for the planet, but you're busy and you have to make 1,000 small decisions every day. So, for answers to these environmental conundrums and your questions, subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's more likely to be real, unicorns or the Loch Ness Monster?
I can't answer that for you.
Why not?